Good morning. Lawmakers are in the process of trying to find agreement on several law enforcement bills, including some that would create oversight and training boards. A criminal justice professor, now a Manoa PhD candidate and former police officer, Aaron Hunger, gives us his take this morning. And we'll look at the Hawaii economy through the eyes of visiting Ameriprise senior economist Russell Price. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hawaii Pacific University's spring concert will feature a virtuoso of the erhu, or Chinese violin. We'll hear from conductor Jeremy Wong. And Malama Kauai's Earth Day Rising 6 Festival will be a full day of workshops and career training for the next generation of agriculturists.
That's the conversation for Thursday, April 21st, coming up right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
A little bit shocked about Prince.
Woke up this morning very early to find that those reports were just starting to make their way through the news cycle, and really shocking, and waiting to find out exactly why Prince is now gone.
Yeah, quite a loss, though.
A genius.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we're going to be hearing more about that later today, no doubt. But first, we're going to take a look at something that I think you know pretty well, including these fundamentals, that Hawaii tourism is the state's number one industry and is the bellwether of the Hawaii economy. In the last few years, Hawaii has recorded stellar numbers in visitors and their spending. But with global and U.S. domestic factors showing a decidedly mixed picture, how will oil and gas prices, a strong U.S. dollar, creeping interest rates, and some slowing Asian economies affect ours, our state? Well, visiting Ameriprise financial senior economist Russell Price joins us now with his view. Good morning, and thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We always find it interesting to see what someone looking outside of Hawaii sees when they look in at us. What do you see?
Well, I think what's likely remain very important to the Hawaiian economy is the health of economic activity, not just in the United States, but for a lot of the countries that tourists come to Hawaii from. And in that respect, I think conditions are good, not great by any means. The United States continues to grow at a modest pace of maybe 2% this year, which, although that's not too much different than what we grew last year or the year before. And although Japan is likely to see relatively flat growth, somewhere between 0 and 1% this year, and I think the pace of activity in China, some of the concerns are a little bit overdone.
Are they really overblown? Because we continue to hear that we should be concerned about what's happening with the Chinese economy, that we should be, you know, really looking at that. And even just the perception of that has changed how other people behave.
Sure. China's economy is decelerating. There's no question about that. But one of the main factors for that deceleration is simple. The law of large numbers in mathematics is the size of their underlying economy grows larger, it becomes much more difficult to grow on a percentage basis. They do have some structural issues. They have too much debt. Their debt levels are still less than what they are here in the United States, and they're working through some of those issues.
But the question is, who's shouldering that debt?
Sure. Most of the debt is held at the local government level as well as the corporate level. But too many times when people think of China as a real threat, economically speaking, they pick up American way of doing things and they put it on top of the Chinese economy. It's not the way things are going to evolve in China. They run under a different system.
So give me an example of why we might be doing that and how that might look to us.
Sure. The corporate sector in China has too much debt. A lot of those corporations, particularly the larger corporations, are state-owned enterprises. The government owns a large majority stake in those companies. Here in the United States, if those companies had taken out too much debt, they'd become insolvent, they'd immediately fold, and they'd lay everyone off, and they'd be out of business. That doesn't happen in China unless the government tells them that that's going to happen, especially for those state-owned enterprises. So there is overcapacity related to too much debt in China, particularly in areas such as steel and mining and cement manufacturing. The Chinese government has said that this year they will lay off two million people. The government will reallocate or help those people get jobs elsewhere. That is significantly less than what happened in the late 1990s. In the late 1990s, China was in a similar situation. It had grown too fast, acquired too much debt. They laid off 30 million people. That was a problem. So they know that this time they have to be much more ease into that problem and reduce those overcapacity levels modestly.
So you don't see that there is going to be an issue with Chinese visitors coming to Hawaii?
I do not. I think the Chinese government is going to be able to manage this moderation in the pace of its growth over the long term. There will be problems, just like there are always problems in any other economy. But I think, generally, they have the resources to manage the problem. They have a lot of foreign currency reserves. They have relatively low government debt levels. They should be able to manage it, in my view.
What about the strength of the American dollar?
The dollar has been exceptionally strong. That's a real impediment to the pace of economic growth here in the United States because, as you know, here in Hawaii, it makes it more expensive for foreign visitors to come as tourists to Hawaii. It also makes it more expensive for a lot of American companies to sell their goods and services outside the United States in general, or, you know, where products are just that much more expensive. So the good news is that recently the dollar has been easing a little bit in its value. It's been coming off of its highs because it jumped by 25% from the middle of 2014 to the end of 2015. Much too strong, much too fast. Over the short period of time, that helped the economies in Europe because of the lower euro, as well as it gave some support to the Japanese economy, as well as other economies. Over time, I think we should see some reversion to the mean. In other words, the dollar should ease in value as the global economy gets a little bit better traction.
Let's talk about oil prices. We know that every time that we see them fall, that's good news sometimes at the pump, but not necessarily good news when it comes to getting on a plane.
That's true. Oil prices, we've seen oil prices drop from, they were $100, $110 for many years. Again, right about the middle of 2014, they started to decline. We recently, in February, we hit a low of $26. Over the last few days, it's been about $42 a barrel for crude oil. That's likely where it's going to reside, somewhere between 35 and 45 for quite some time. By that, I mean maybe the next 2 years. The reason being is Saudi Arabia realizes they allowed crude oil prices to remain too high for too long, and all that did was spur additional drilling activity in places like the United States and China. They lost market share. They knew that the price was too high. They allowed it to come down. Even their their oil minister has said that you will not see $100 a barrel oil for at least another 10 years.
So if you were to overlay that with what we know we have to deal with here, even just going to visit relatives on a neighbor island, getting on a plane, does that have any impact in your mind that we're going to see maybe some falling airline prices? Or, I mean, because Lyft is always a big thing for us, getting people here and being able to go visit the relatives on the neighbor islands.
Right. You know, the way people perceive things, where when oil prices are going up, the cost that's passed on to us through higher airline tickets or higher gas pump prices, they're passed on much more quickly than when the prices are coming down. Unfortunately, that's true. The data shows that very clearly. So eventually, for the time being, those airlines are seeing a better profit margin. Eventually, competition should bring those prices back down to some degree because obviously they're paying less for jet fuel. So the cost of transporting people should be less. They should see some pressure to lower prices over time.
What kind of time frame do you think that we're looking at with that? Because, I mean, truly, we know that the fuel that was that they're using now was purchased quite a while ago when, you know, we're trying to maybe hedge a bet that it's going to be a little bit lower at that point, seeing that as being the lowest price and thinking, well, maybe that may be the way it's going to go, but not necessarily, as you say, translating into a lower price for us until way further out into the future, maybe a couple of years.
Well, I wouldn't say a couple of years. I would say maybe a few quarters of time. I'm certainly no expert on the airline industry, but companies are in the they'll seek to get the most profit as they can. If the plane is still full at a higher price, well, that's what the price is going to be.
Which is what we've seen in the last couple of years, even though we know that we were all paying, you know, smaller energy bills and getting a bit of a, you know, nice gift at the pump.
That's right. And over time, more competition. If those airlines are making good profits, that'll attract more flights into the market. It'll attract maybe other airlines into the market to garner some of those higher profits, and that will create more competition and bring those prices down over time. But you're right, it does take probably at least a few quarters for that to occur.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us this morning. I know you're here for some private events, and glad to be able to speak with you today.
My pleasure.
Russell Price is a senior economist for Ameriprise Financial. He was recently cited by Bloomberg Financial as a Bloomberg Best for being one of the most accurate economic forecasters in their benchmark consensus survey. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:14. Coming up, HPU's orchestra teams up with a virtuoso of the Chinese two-stringed violin, the erhu. But first, your backyard quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohavai.
Today in our backyard quiz, we want to know about a modern-day actor of Hawaiian descent who's risen to prominence in recent years. His acting career was launched in 1999 after he was selected over 1,300 others for a role in a short-lived spinoff of the TV show Baywatch called Baywatch Hawaii. Through the ensuing decade, our mystery actor held roles in a number of television shows and films, including Stargate, Atlantis, and Conan the Barbarian, before landing the role that truly propelled him to international fame. We don't want to make it too easy for you, but the role in question was on a show whose most recent season premieres this week. If you can name this actor, you'll be today's winner, and just call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from the 11th Annual Hawaii Book and Music Festival, celebrating reading, storytelling, and music, April 30th and May 1st on the grounds of Honolulu Hale. Event schedule online at hawaiibookandmusicfestival.com.
Musical combinations between Eastern and Western cultures are always interesting because until fairly recently, the musical traditions of Europe and Asia evolved in isolation from one another. So tonalities, rhythms, and melodies can be radically different. Barriers have come down in the last century or so, and an upcoming collaboration between the Hawaii Pacific University Symphony, Chorale, and International Vocal Ensemble and Shenghui Songhong, a virtuoso of the erhu, will reveal. HPO's Jeremy Wong will conduct the ensemble, and he and Shenghui are both with us this morning. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning, Chris. Nice to be here.
Is this a bit of a musical challenge for a Western orchestra to combine with the erhu?
I think it can be it can work together really nicely. Mm-hmm. However, I have to say, I'm not conducting the orchestra. I'm conducting the choirs tomorrow night.
Uh-huh.
And I think it'll be a really really wonderful event for everyone to attend.
Well, how do you make it work? How do you make this cross-cultural collaboration work?
I think for a long time, you know, it's music really just kind of transcends boundaries, mm-hmm. right? And music is truly that universal language that can really just make that bridge between cultures really evident.
Well, you've brought Chonghui with you this morning. I hope I'm saying your name at least close to what it sounds like.
Yes, you did.
Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me here today.
Let's sort of give a physical description of your instrument. It's got two strings going down to a small bowl covered with snake skin, and that's your resonating chamber.
Yes. This instrument is very special in the way the bowl is actually in between two strings.
Yeah.
And it has this snake skin covered the soundbox. Yeah, it's very unique.
One of the things that is striking when you first hear the instrument is the amount of sliding between pitches that you do, because you don't have any limitations, right?
Yes, there's no fingerboard, no fret, so I can do any pitch I want, so any microtones or any slides I want, yes. And that's kind of the feature of this instrument. You are going to hear a lot this kind of thing.
So playing it depends enormously on your ear, your ability to hear pitches in a very exact way.
Yes, yes, it is, yeah.
Was that tough to learn?
Yeah, but I guess every instrument is tough to learn, but I don't look at this as tough to learn, but I would say this is one of the features of the instrument, and it's kind of fun to have this feature to play around.
Sure. And you alluded to microtones, which, mm-hmm. of course, are the pitches between the keys on the piano. And mm-hmm. Chinese melodies have a great deal of – they're not dependent on the Western 12-tone scale, are they?
Maybe before, but nowadays, especially this time when I play with the Western orchestra, I would really have to play with the Western tonality.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But do you play melodies from – from before?
Yeah, there are some traditional pieces. So, you know, there are kind of notes that you have to kind of link it between notes, and then so a lot of slides and then a lot of vibrato. Yeah.
Can you give us a little sample of one of those older, sort of pre-Western influence melodies?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, this is one of the oldest song from Erhu.
A very wide vibrato on some of those notes, where you're actually pushing down really hard on the string, moving the pitch a half tone or more. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like I said, there's no fingerboard,
right.
So I'm able to push the string really hard in order to change the pitch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you really have the same capabilities that a human voice has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then earlier, you were playing for me a little fragment of something you're going to be playing with a Western orchestra, so that's more in the 12-tone.
Yes, that one is. Yeah, it's more 12 tones, but then also in between there's still a lot of slides.
A lot of slides, yeah.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
Can you play a little bit of that for us?
Sure.
you really could hear the Western and the Eastern in that when you arrived at a note, it was a note on the 12 tone scale,
yes.
But the sliding in between is distinctively Asian Chinese.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you see a lot of openings for fusion of your instrument with Western orchestral music in the future?
Yes, definitely. Nowadays, there are more and more erhu piece play with Western orchestra. In fact, I'm trying to play this instrument with some Hawaiian musicians. So it's going to be fun.
That would fit.
Yeah,
that would fit
that
sort of, especially you've heard this Hawaiian steel guitar,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
does a lot of that sliding between pitches as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe that's an exciting avenue for the future.
Definitely.
Thanks
I'm
so much.
So looking forward to it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, thank
here.
You both for coming in. Jeremy M. Wong will conduct the Hawaii Pacific University Chorale and International Vocals Ensemble. Special guest, Shong Hui Hung, a virtuoso of the erhu. That's in the St. Andrew's Cathedral tomorrow evening. It's HPU's 14th annual spring concert, and admission is free.
A bright jewel with a dark past, India, the world's biggest democracy, demands justice over one of the world's biggest diamonds, which now lives in the centerpiece of Queen Elizabeth's crown. A birthday message to the Queen. We'd like our diamond back next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providers of auto, home, commercial, and specialty lines of insurance since 1911. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
The versions of the contentious water rights bill is in conference in the legislature, and it still looks like they are far apart. And so are the opinions over the announcement by Alexander and Baldwin yesterday that it will restore some stream flow to taro farmers in East Maui. Chad Blair from Civil Beat has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, I mean, was this as much of a surprise as it seemed to be when that announcement was made yesterday?
Well, I think the timing certainly was suspect. On the very day that this controversial bill, that's House Bill 2501, a water rights bill, was going to be heard, A and B and key lawmakers, particularly ones from Maui, held this big press conference saying, A and B is going to, you know, restore some of those streams, which, as you know, has been a contentious issue, well, for over 100 years. And that bill, the question in that bill is whether it will favor A and B. In an initial draft, that bill seemed to give them the opportunity to continue leasing water in East Maui and diverting it to Central Maui, where their agricultural interests are. In the current draft of the bill, A and B is not in there, but the big suspicion among some sectors is that the final bill will include A and B being protected.
There's still the issue of whether it is illegally diverting water, based on what we heard from the judge last January.
Well, it's not a mystery for Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation or the Sierra Club of Hawaii, who say the court order made quite clear that A and B has been in violation, that it should stop diverting this water. It is a contested case that is going on right now. That ruling is also under appeal. So that is working its way through. But bottom line, A and B still controls that water. It's still being diverted millions of gallons every single day. So that is continuing even while A and B is making this magnanimous gesture by some standards to restore some of those water rights.
Is it really that magnanimous a gesture in terms of how it's being received? I mean, there's been sort of this, well, it's a step in the right direction kind of feel that we've been getting from a lot of the lawmakers and certainly from some who are in organizations like the Sierra Club looking at it, but certainly not convinced that this is going to do what should be happening.
Some of the lawmakers said that it looks like we're on the path to a middle of ground, some sort of compromise on this HB 2501, but in larger question of settling the water rights issue. But others are saying this is really just sort of a smokescreen. You're diverting our attention while what's really going on is A&B is trying to, you know, get this legislation crafted on its behalf. There are strong opinions on both sides, and we're going to continue to see how it develops. That bill has another hearing today, a conference committee hearing at the legislature.
And yesterday, virtually what, nothing happened?
No. Basically what happened is the House said, we don't like the Senate version. Why don't you take back our old House version? We like that the best. So it's a standoff, a classic standoff between what the House wants and what the Senate wants. Remember, Joe Suki, the House Speaker from Maui, is an author of that bill.
Right. Well, we'll see if they're still as far apart after today, but it looks like they got a long way to go. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair brings us a reality check every day from Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann will be bringing us Town Square, looking at the right to try bills.
Right. We talk a lot about, you know, the right to die, but not so much about the right to try, which exists in many other states, and we're going to talk about that tonight. Should doctors be allowed to prescribe medicines being used in clinical trials to treat terminally ill patients? That's what we're going to take up later on tonight.
Powerful arguments on both sides of that discussion.
Including, you know, do we need this? I mean, the AG says there's some legal issues with it. Certainly the emotional reaction is, well, you know, if people are told that they are going to be dying, why shouldn't they be allowed to try medicines that, you know, may have some other effects? But who knows if that's their last grasp at it. But we're going to look at all that in some of the shades and nuances. We're going to have Senator Josh Green, who is a co-introducer of the bill. Also, Dr. Ken Kipnis, who will be here. He's a medical ethicist at UH Manoa. And we also invited the AG's office to participate. Unfortunately, with so much going on, they were unable to be with us later on tonight.
It's a situation that can put patients in a position of wondering who decides about their something very intimate to themselves. Right,
right, because you're also talking about issues of insurance. You know, should insurers be made to pay for those experimental or clinical trial treatments? And what does that mean for ratepayers?
That's where it gets even more complicated.
You bet. We'll take on some of those complications tonight at 5 on Town Square. See you then. The bills to improve oversight of police activities are now in the conference committee. Even before they went to conference, all underwent several revisions. The three bills we're going to look at this morning are the Body Camera Funding and Standards Bill, the measures to create an independent review board to investigate incidents of officer-involved death, and an advisory law enforcement employment standards and training board. Aaron Hunger is a criminal justice professor at Remington College. He's also a former police officer. We've asked him into our studio for his read of the current versions as he was involved with the creation of two of them. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be involved in this conversation this morning.
Aaron, you helped to craft some of the original legislation that was introduced this time around. How far has it come from those two bills?
So that's correct. I was involved in a 5-year research study with the University of Hawaii. I'm also a doctoral researcher at the university, and my project involved assessing some of the mechanisms within the police bureaucracy in the counties and how well accountability systems were working. What we found was that there were some critical components that are missing in this state that are present in all other states whose responsibility is for oversight and accountability of police through licensing at the state mechanism. This had the effect of causing a lot of autonomy when it came to police conduct and oversight, that intersection. And so the study really was focused on trying to get legislators involved in addressing some of this. So the policies started, the policy development started late last year with public safety legislators specifically, as they were going to be the ones who had to introduce the bills, and trying to sort of show them the data that existed that we had collected and suggest some remedies that had been used in other cities and other police departments that might be of interest.
Specifically, you're talking about the creation of the Law Enforcement Standard Board and also the independent review when there's an officer-involved death.
Correct. So two of the big areas where cities are starting to have conversations about police accountability involve police homicides. That's clear around the country.
But from the initial crafting of those two bills to where they are now, several revisions down the way, the big criticism has become, well, they've become even more toothless than perhaps they might have started out to be.
And that's correct. They have undergone several revisions that have tried to negotiate with the key actors who this would affect, and also tried to take into account that we're starting with nothing. So as it looks from the outside, well, you know, the bill has really been toned down, and it has. There's no doubt about it.
Both bills?
Well, all three bills.
Well, I mean, I'm talking specifically about the two that you were involved with. We'll get to the body cam bill in a minute.
Correct. Yes, the two bills that were originally drafted had much more oversight mechanisms within the language than the current revisions have. And again, this was to try to accommodate a lot of the players who were very critical and very resistant of trying to get on board with this type of legislation, specifically the police union and the county police agencies who would be most affected by this legislation. This legislation creates mechanisms that were originally intended to professionally license police officers as part of the entire oversight bureaucracy. However, that component was taken out. There was a lot of objections of they weren't sure how that structure would take place. And so, unfortunately, that has been taken out. That said, to have something to work from in the future and expand authority from is a lot easier than having nothing and trying to get a bureaucracy agreed upon within the legislation. And so
you're making the foot in the door argument.
Absolutely. And at this point, being the only state that is missing these type of critical components, it's better to get the foot in the door and have the agency created and have it existing so that you can expand its authority, address what's not working, see how the community reacts to this, get the professionals used to its existence rather than having all the medicine applied at once.
How close do you think that these two versions, at least that they're looking at now, are in conference to be able to even get that agency created?
Well, I've continued to have dialogues with the authors of the bill. Senator Aspero has been one of the key advocates of both of these bills. He is the author of both of the bills, and so he's really in touch with where the other legislators are. And like you just heard from Civil Beat, we're in a part of the legislative process where the House is rejecting what they want to hear and the Senate's rejecting what they want to hear. So for advocates, this is a nervous time. We play the least role right now. This is where the legislators have all the say in whether the bill can be worked out and whether it can move on.
And done behind closed doors.
Absolutely.
But clearly, I mean, the coconut wireless works well. Are you hearing that this is something that we may well see happen?
I'm hearing that this year, more than any other, there is a strong will within the legislature to pass something that addresses what's going on within all of the counties. And it's, although there's certain counties that appear to be more problematic with policing oversight than others, there is evidence going through all counties that there really should be some discussions as to how we can help police train and how we can get them professionalized throughout the state.
Now, what about the body cam funding bill?
So body camera is one of those national priorities. In fact, so much so that the federal government has created several avenues for cities to get aid in funding should that be problematic. There's a lot of data that shows on both ends that this is something that aids officer safety and it aids public safety. Oakland and San Francisco's police departments turned over statistical data that was really helpful in selling these to police departments, that it's a way to cut down on citizens being aggressive with police officers as they understand they're on film and they don't always want to be seen as aggressive when they know that that's going to be played out in court. And likewise, the SHOPO union president pointed out it's a way to remind officers that they're also expected to act professionally at all times, and having the camera there has had that effect. And so what chiefs of police have said is that the number of citizen complaints have dropped, the number of use of force have dropped, and so cameras are a real tool for governments to help in this relationship.
Right, you're making the case for it, but specifically as you look at this bill, SB 2411, which has gone through two revisions in the Senate and two revisions in the House, do you think that this bill is actually going to also be that foot in the door to be able to get funding or additional funding for body cams?
Well, I will tell you this. One of the main perceived opponents to the bill was, of course, SHOPO, and secondly was Honolulu Police. But in the last House testimonial, Honolulu Police changed their position 180 degrees and said that they were not only ready to institute a pilot program, but they were ready to institute it by the end of summer.
Mm-hmm.
That said, that, I think, shows a real willingness of the major obstacles to be overcome. So
right, but the language that would have to be agreed upon with two different versions that have come through the Senate and two different versions that have come through the House.
Right. I understand that the contention is around some of the audio versions of concerns between the Attorney General and what can be overheard as people try to listen to transmissions through the radio. So it's not so much the camera portion of the bill that's under contention, is there's an audio portion that's really contentious.
But all of this has money tied to it as
correct.
Well, and that's part of the big sticking point as well.
That's right. It's got to get through the financing, which is always problematic.
All right. Well, we're going to be watching, and we know you will be too. Thanks very much for coming in, Aaron.
Thank you so much.
Aaron Hunger is a former police officer. He also is a criminal justice instructor and a researcher at the University of Hawaii Manoa, where he's finishing his PhD in political science. He worked on two of the bills that we just talked about, SB 2755, the Law Enforcement Standards Board, and SB 2196, the Law Enforcement Independent Review Board, now in conference. And now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Now, today we asked you about an actor with Hawaii roots who has risen to international prominence. Although he was born in Honolulu, our future star was raised in Iowa. He went into acting with no formal training or experience after being selected for a role in Baywatch, Hawaii. And although he appeared in several films and TV shows in the interim, It was his performance as the warrior king Khal Drogo in HBO's Game of Thrones that made him a household name. He secured the role after performing a Maori war dance, or haka, at his audition. Off screen, he was seen on Mauna Kea supporting protesters of the 30-meter telescope last year. And if you haven't guessed by now, the name we were looking for is Jason Momoa.
And Beth Ann, a number of people knew that. The winner of the T-shirt today is Jun Hung of Salt Lake, but we also got calls from Robert in Kalihi, Marisha in downtown Honolulu, and Bill Schwab in Honolulu. So that was a hot one.
Oh, I'm certainly that's going to make Jason Momoa very happy, too. And now at 8:47, that was the answer to today's quiz. If you've got a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Hawaii Pacific University, presenting its 14th annual spring concert featuring guest artist Chun Wei Hung tomorrow evening at 7 at the Cathedral of St. Andrew, hpu.edu/events.
Farming on the local sustainable level might just be the career of the future, with organizations like Malama Kauai working to educate young agriculturalists in a value system that draws from ancient practices as it draws on new technologies. Both will be in evidence on Sunday when Malama Kauai celebrates Earth Day Rising 6, an all-day festival at its community farm in Kalihi Wai. Megan Fox is part of the team that's putting it together, and she's on the line with us. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You keeping busy getting this thing off the ground?
Absolutely. We're all here down on the farm, cleaning up, getting ready. Very excited.
I'm looking at some pictures I've seen on your website of a lot of young people in your various training programs. It really is looking like the wave of the future, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think we have to make it the wave of the future. If we want more food self-reliance in Hawaii, we really have to focus on our youth. And, you know, we've been doing Kauai School Garden Network now since 2010. So we just started some new programs, you know, instead of just farm to school, doing school to farm and getting kids paid ag internships over school breaks so that they can really get mentored by our existing farmers and kind of build a succession of new farmers coming up.
Farm to school as opposed to school to farm, what's the difference?
Yeah, a farm to school is bringing the farmers to the schools.
Okay.
So whether that's, you know, helping to incorporate more local food into the school food programs or taking kids on field trips to farms, having them do school gardens, and really this new, school to farm is actually getting the kids in the agricultural classes to go out and, kind of build their first professional development experiences in agriculture and show them what a career pathway like that might look like.
And just get out in the dirt, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. And we have, Kauai actually has one of the lowest or the highest unemployment rates in the state for youth. So it's a really great opportunity even just to provide, you know, healthy, active employment opportunities for kids.
Sure.
It might be their first work experience.
You know, in order to learn how to be a farmer, in order to learn agriculture, you have to learn all kinds of techniques of growing and things like that. But there's also, is it fair to say there's a kind of whole value system that goes along with it?
There is, and I think that's maybe our biggest challenge in getting new farmers is having kids redefine what success means to them. You know, for some people it's a big truck and a big house and all these things. For other people, it's a healthy community and a healthy, happy lifestyle and doing good for your community. And kind of we do touch on a lot of that. So I think that's an important way of kind of defining what kids want out of their future, too.
Well, yeah, because most people who go into farming will tell you there are easier ways to get rich, right?
Absolutely.
But at the same time, people who work in agriculture might also tell you there are a few more rewarding ways to spend your life. That's kind of what you're saying, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that's, that's what a lot of, if you talk to the farmers, that's how they feel.
Sure.
You know, the success to them is definitely not about the money.
Well, is that something that today's young people have, you know, how well do they absorb that idea?
You know, pretty well. It's kind of interesting because, I think their parents were told, don't get into farming.
Yeah.
You know, it's a horrible life. You're going to work so hard and not make anything. And
right.
Because maybe their parents had come from an agricultural background and they wanted something different for their kids. And now kind of that third generation in, they're starting to look back at the quality of life and the just the feeling of being out on the land and helping their community by feeding them. And the kids today are definitely, they have a lot of strong values. They're very positive and idealistic, and it's kind of exciting to get that new wave in.
But it is there's no getting around the dawn to dusk commitment, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a challenge that really everybody faces in ag. And you know, it's funny because everybody, when we started this program, was like, oh, our kids are lazy. They don't want to farm. But, you know, it's amazing how many applicants you get to the program. And kids are lining up. They're really excited by the opportunity to work. And our internships are full-time this summer, and we still have a huge list of kids that are like, I want to be outside working hard all summer. So, there's something more rewarding to it that gets past the hard work there.
Do some of them drop out? Do some of them find that the work ethic is really more than they were ready to take on? Or do they come in pretty ready for that idea?
You know, most of them have come in pretty ready. This is good. This summer's internship program is going to be our third session, so we have a lot of return students. So we really try to recruit from the high school agriculture programs that are involved in our school garden network, because they'll know who legitimately has the potential and interest in a career in agriculture, and we get to work with the kids and get to know them. So that's really helped in finding people that are genuinely interested in that career pathway, so that we're exposing the right people to those opportunities too.
As they sort of come of age and take over the world, they're going to be moving agriculture in a very different direction than the past generation, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of exciting. We just had a presentation recently on COI about agriculture. And, you know, one of the things that's happened since 1980 is that our diversified crops have grown approximately 220% in those years. So that's pretty exciting. I think people are more focused on creating food for local consumption now, and the demand is really strong. So that's really what our program focuses on too, is getting kids on farms that are actually producing a variety of foods for our island to increase that food sovereignty.
That's a huge shift, particularly on Kauai, which was dominated by plantations for such a long time.
Right. Right. I mean, as is most of Hawaii, it's really interesting, especially with some of the big closures and things like that happening around the islands. I think we're seeing more land free up, and we need the people just to work the land and say, I want it, I'm ready.
We need the people,
so
Megan.
That's
you're
really what the program's about, you know, is creating our new farmers and fostering the ones who are interested.
Well, we do need those people, Megan. Thanks very much for taking the time this morning.
Yeah.
Megan Fox of Malama Kauai is one of the coordinators of Earth Day Rising 6. It's all day Sunday at Malama Kauai's community farm in Kalihiwai, Kauai.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Tom's River describes how one mother realized it must be pollution that was killing dozens of New Jersey children.
Whenever Linda had to take Michael in for treatment, she would meet another family from Tom's River. She wondered, why are there so many kids getting treated for cancer from Tom's River?
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason. tonight at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
It was encouraging, Beth Ann, to hear from Malama Kauai, Megan at Malama Kauai, that young people are going into agriculture adapted to the real dawn-to-dusk work ethic that agriculture demands.
Because so often we hear that that's, you know, not the case. We always hear about older farmers and what's going to happen to ag. And, yeah. And I mean, there's really a mixed bag in there. But you talk about those who really feel called to do it. You're right. It's a very different life.
And her stat, what was it? Over 200% increase in diversified agriculture. Of course, we've been hearing for a generation or more that that's what we need. It might be actually be happening.
And hearing more about that's what's going to be happening on Central Maui, too. So we'll hear about that more and have further conversations as we see what really is going to go down. But for tomorrow's agenda, we know we're going to talk about zero waste. We're going to follow up our own zero waste initiative, talking to Ku'ule Williams, the executive director of Aloha Harvest.
And world-traveling storyteller Margaret Reed McDonald sets forth on a tour of Hawaii libraries.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like. It's always open at 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
You can find past shows on our archive under The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you later tonight for Town Square, and we'll both be back tomorrow morning with more of The Conversation.